This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, I love you, Wanda. Terrence Hayes was 30 when he first met the poet Wanda Coleman. They shared a stage at the Schomburg Center in New York in 2001, but he doesn't have a detailed memory of the event. He'd been reading Wanda Coleman's poetry for years and was simply too awestruck to notice much beyond, quote, her frenetic, sometimes lyrical voice, her towering hair and bangles, and big, wicked laugh, end quote. Still, a friendship developed between this tall kid, as Terrence Hayes describes himself through her eyes, and Wanda Coleman, who was 25 years his senior and had already lived a life so full and often so difficult, it's a miracle she got any writing done at all, let alone 20 books of poetry and prose. Wanda Coleman was born in L.A. in 1946, and as a girl, she loved music and she loved to read. But she was also politicized pretty early on, whether she liked it or not. She once wrote, "If I sneeze, it's political." She met with racism and colorism in school from both kids and teachers. At 11, when she was deadly ill with meningitis, the hospital refused to admit her, a black girl, and her parents had to carry her back to the car and drive to another hospital. As an adult, she was often met with violent treatment by police, about which she once wrote, quote, "Weighing well over 150, I favor pantsuits and boots. Could I unwittingly be tapping into hostilities usually reserved for black men?" End quote. Then there was a political context. The summer she graduated high school, the Civil Rights Act was passed. She went to protests against a war in Vietnam and Black Panther-led mutual aid meetings. A year later, she saw her neighborhood of Watts erupt in rage over decades of police violence and lack of opportunity. It would happen again almost three decades later, when a jury in Simi Valley acquitted the policeman who'd beaten Rodney King. In between, she wrote while working a few jobs and raising her three kids. Her son Anthony would die of AIDS when he was only 31. And she struggled with grinding poverty pretty much throughout her life. When I sat down with Terrence Hayes, I wanted to know, as he was reading through her poems and deciding which ones should go into the selected poems, Wicked Enchantment, how much her biography mattered to him.
Were you also making an effort to be clear about what happened in her life? Where was she born? Like, what did her parents do? What were the big sort of events in her life? Did you keep that in mind at all, or were you not so interested in that?
No. It's partially why I chose those segments from her nonfiction book she wrote, The Riot Inside Me, because, it really could be three movies probably for the different kinds of ways she lived, the many kinds of lives that she had. Having said that, you know, the premise of, like, what a friendship would be, for me anyway, between poets, it's usually about poetry. So, you know, anything else that I would learn about her would be via the poems, whether they were imagined or whether they were autobiographical. I think we were just bound by poems.
Yeah. I am still going to ask you a few questions about her life.
Sure.
I wanted to start with her childhood.
Sure.
It seems like she was a little bit bored at school, or like at school she wasn't getting what she needed. And so she gave herself an education of sorts. Like, she read the completed works of Shakespeare by age 10. Then in high school, she went on to, as she calls them, the heavyweights, Sartre, Nietzsche, mm-hmm. Heidegger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As well as playing the piano.
Yeah, and a violin too,
learning,
right?
Instruments. Yeah, quite a bit.
Yeah. How what I'm just curious about is how come she ended up reading Sartre, Nietzsche, Heidegger? Those are not the most likely names.
Why does anyone end up reading those things? I think, yeah, she was a curious person. How about this? So I'm just going to do this again, analogy of what something I sort of riffed on in the introduction, which was her personality, which was intense and fiery. And I pretty much said, Miles Davis was also very intense and fiery, even with the acknowledgement that he was a genius. He still felt like in his body and even his upbringing, the class that he came up with, his dad was a dentist, I believe, was very wealthy. So for him to go out into the world and hit with his dark-skinned, brilliant self, he was always angry about people sort of seeing something other than that brilliance.
Yeah.
Wanda Coleman, same way, except in the introduction, I'm like, but say that no one ever even acknowledged to the degree that they did Miles Davis's trumpet playing. Say he never really got outside of, I'm not gonna say Illinois, but outside of the village. And so that's an even more outrage to Miles Davis. And so that is the parallel that I would say to you. So to draw back to your question, it was really like, you know, she was a brilliant and curious being. As she tells it, the thing that sort of further isolated her was coming to terms with her body. I don't think her parents sent her out into the world saying, you know, they're going to call you big, black, and nappy. I think they sent her out into the world letting her be her curious and brilliant and talented self. They trained her to be that person. And so the things that she met on the other side of that are the things that sort of outraged her. That makes any sense. So I'm saying, like, you know, she was brilliant. That's why she did these things, period. There was no other reason. She's just as brilliant as anybody else that finds these things at a certain age. And the thing that sort of warped or shaped that brilliance was this idea that other people weren't seeing it. They were seeing something else before they saw it. But it's everywhere from the beginning of her life to the end that the genius is just there all the time with this outrage. And I think that's the relationship between that outrage.
You know, yes, she was confronted with people's ugly opinions of her as soon as she went out, but she was also confronted with those in those books. I mean, you know, Nietzsche is this whole theory about the Übermensch, and it was later used kind of by Hitler and his, like, superiority complex. And Heidegger was a card-carrying Nazi. I mean, like, I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, you can't read, of course, right?
Sure you can, because she was a critical thinker. Yes. I mean, reading those things doesn't mean she has to absorb everything of it. I mean, I think she was a thing that I joke about sometimes, but like every thought has at least six sides to it. So you just, you stand on this side of the thought and it seems like that's it. It's a wall and you turn this corner. And so the idea is like the true critical thinker is always trying to, like, not just even on a black and white side, not like what's on the other side of the wall, but how many, you know, dimensions are there to any sort of anything in the universe. How about that? And I think that that was what she was, a critical thinker. I'll also say it's in her work, because in Mercurochrome, she has a section called the Rogue Anthology, where she's just imitating every poem from this contemporary American poet from maybe 1969, Mark Strand edited. So there's people like A.R. Armis, Mark Strand, Frank O'Hara, Denise Levertov, all the people that were sort of really important at that point. She took it on her own, because this is really early on in the, you know, in her process. I mean, she brought Mercurochrome as published a little later. So let's just say from the beginning, she was looking at what people were doing, imitating what they were doing, and sometimes critiquing it in a positive way, sometimes in a not so positive way. And if you go back and look at those poems, I think people will see what I'm talking about in terms of the kind of critique she would level. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah. She wasn't above both learning from Heidegger and also leveling a critique, that because she was a critical thinker.
Right. You know, when she graduated high school, this was 1964.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot was happening in LA. There were all these love-ins and sit-ins. Like, all of that stuff was going on, and she was sort of in there. But she also fell in love, got married, had a kid at 18. What do you know about her days then? Like her day-to-day, and what the politics meant to her.
She had two by 20, right? The first one, she was 18. The second one, she was 20. So when I saw that line, I just sort of thought about my mother, who had me when she was 16, and had my brother when she was 20. So similarly, had two kids by the time she was 20. Mostly, I think about how much my mother was still a young girl at that time, how much she still had the intensity of a young woman, not necessarily the wisdom or the insights of a mother.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother never became a poet. I wouldn't think of her in any sort of way as an artist, but I do think of her as someone who was brilliant and, you know, an inability to kind of, like, I don't know, capitalize, benefit from, grow into that brilliance that, you know, many black women experience, I think. Wanda Coleman is just someone who was able to really tap into that. So much of that stuff is right where it should be in the poems.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, in the book, you'll find those early poems where she is thinking about and talking about the complexities of being a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't sum it up. I wouldn't summarize it. I would say the poems are a record of those challenges she faced early on and later on, too.
Yeah. Is there a poem that you think, this is a poem I'd want to read about that early motherhood?
The motherhood. Yeah, the critique even of motherhood. What's that poem called? Is it "Tis Morning Makes Mother a Killer" on page 39? I mean, the title tells you some of what I'm talking about. "'Tis morning makes mother a killer, mean. The day grinds its way slowly into her back. A bad mattress stiffens her jaw. It is the mindless banalities that pass as conversation between coworkers. Her paycheck spread too thin across the bread of weeks. Too much gristle and bone and not enough blood. Meatless meals of beans and cornbread, nights in the electric arms of the tube, mean as a bear, carrying groceries home in this rain and shoes twice resoled and feverish with flu. It is early dawn, mocking her unfinished efforts, unpaid bills, unanswered letters, unironed clothes, tracks of pain in her face left by time, the fickle high of it, facing the mirror of black flesh, mean as mean can pushed to the floor, but max is not max enough. No power, out of control, anxiety. It is the sun illuminating cobwebs that strips her of her haunted beauty, reveals the hag at her desperate hour. Children, beware." So, I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, like, you know, the other thing about the way she writes is that none of these things are like one-offs. So it's not like she writes that poem and she's like, okay, I covered how hard it is to be. I mean, the poems would come as they needed to come. So that's why I was like, that's one of them. But that sentiment, these questions of like where she was and how she was feeling, it just comes up a lot. Sometimes it's the subject of a poem. Sometimes it's an aside in a poem. Yeah. And again, I'm talking about all these different kinds of kind of recurring just human challenges, motherhood, lover, worker, poet, all these things are just really from the very beginning things that she's contending with as she tries to, you know, raise her family.
Yeah, I also read that she, in a way, by this kind of compressed time frame that she was operating within, you know, that pushed her towards poetry, that she was, you know, writing short stories and essays and stuff before. But, you know, with kids, she didn't have the time. And so you could always write a line or two, you know, waiting at the supermarket, you know, or something like that. So she did. And I just wonder how that compares to how you write and your process. And if you see that difference on the page.
Well, I'll say for myself, so I don't even think of myself as having any particular kind of process except to just get something done. So I just try not to come up with too many rituals in that way, except for like being home. So already, as soon as I think about like the kinds of windows I can give myself to work, I know that I'm in a different sort of privilege than she was because of so much that was circling around her all the time through her whole life, whether it was husband, kids, jobs, again. So I don't think she was able to find that kind of space. And of course, that's one of the things that I admire about her, that she was still able to write so much during that time. So there is like, I don't know if I would call it folklore or, you know, where this category goes, but supposedly she would get more money if the books were bigger when she was with Black Sparrow. I don't know. She told me that, if I just heard that somewhere. So every time she was writing as much as she could to get one of those big 300 page books, because that would be money. So what that means is like there's a lot of work. All of those books are super thick. And so going through them, they made my job very easy because it was easy to find a lot of stuff. But I also felt like I left a lot of really good and interesting things on the cutting floor, I guess. So again, I would encourage everybody to get those other books. But that is to say, she sort of, because of, let's just like needing money, let's say there were economic pressures on what she was doing. So essentially she was like, well, if I gotta write a thick book, I gotta write every day.
Yeah.
So I was always impressed by that. But you see that in a lot of those Black Sparrow poets, like those books are always thick. And you might say sometimes uneven because of that, but it's just a wealth of riches. Mm-hmm. Even Bukowski, you know, similar kind of poet in terms of like super productive, despite all the kinds of challenges that might have been, you know, at his feet. And so I think all of those poets had a similar kind of work ethic in terms of productivity.
Well, if you have this incentive to pad your books, or maybe that's uncharitable, you know, but like to deliver to your publisher 300 pages rather than 100 that you're really happy with. Does that mean that it was easier in a way to see her learn on the page because there was more of it there? The youthful mistakes were kind of right there.
Yeah, great observation. I would say that's certainly true. And yeah, I mean, again, if I think about myself, yeah, I just write all the time and I don't think too much about it. I don't put everything I write out in the world. You know what I mean? If I write 100 things, maybe 10 of them will make it to sunlight. But I do know that when I'm revising a poem or moving things that are in a poem, I know that I'm sort of protecting myself in some way from the kinds of vulnerabilities that come from writing all the time and letting the weak stuff sit next to the brilliant stuff, or maybe not even in distinguishing it. I mean, which I also think about Wanda Coleman, like, there's so many poems that I just think are brilliant, brilliant poems, but was she thinking of them as she wrote them because of the speed in which she was writing them is like, this is the best poem I ever wrote. I think she was like, that's the poem I wrote on Tuesday, this is the poem I wrote on Wednesday, and sort of move forward that way, which is what I try to do as well.
Yes. Well, I'm asking you about, you know, what you, if you saw her learn on the page, because there's this moment early on in her life where, you know, she wants to be a writer and she's sending out poem after poem after poem and it's just getting rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at some point, as she tells it, she's collected 3,000 rejection slips.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point,
mm-hmm.
she thinks, well, I must be doing something wrong,
right.
You know? And I think one of the things that I think she's trying to work out at that time is what to do with her rage.
Right.
Like, okay, I don't want to just have an angry outburst on the page. That does not make a poem, you know?
Sure, sure.
And so I'm wondering, since you were able, in all of that she's published, kind of more trace and track how she was learning, what can you tell me about some things that you noticed, like where you noticed her figuring out how to write her rage into a poem?
Well, she says something that I used to say about people before I knew she said it, and then she extends it. So what I would say to people is, Wanda Coleman's on Black Sparrow, and the star of Black Sparrow for most of that time is Charles Bukowski. So what I would say to people who weren't familiar with her, but maybe knew who Bukowski was, is like, well, it's like if Bukowski was a black woman from Watts. And those earlier poems are like that. So rage, but also just inappropriate, raunchy. She's got a poem where she's having sex with her partner and then the cops burst in and there's all the things that happen, you know, so.
And then they leave and they continue on.
Yeah. So that rage that you're talking about, I would invoke Bukowski, but I would also invoke maybe Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
So it's not always the wolf, which she talks about in the poems. It's also like other kinds of ways that she's shaping that rage. So I say again, when I was looking at her work, I thought Bukowski was her man. So I was like, oh, that's what she was studying. That's mm-hmm. why they were on Black Sparrow.
Mm-hmm.
But then she says she just realized they weren't alike because he just didn't have the same kind of music that she does.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Just a different kind of ear. She's a very lyrical poet. She likes to play with her sentences. She's not always going to be narrative in the way that Bukowski might be narrative. And those Bukowski poems, you know, they're him. And you can kind of hear his delivery if you ever heard him speak. Her poems, if you've ever heard her delivery, she changes her voice, she changes her pitch. So it is like she's projecting a kind of persona on the poems,
mm-hmm.
or various kinds of personas on the poems. So again, those earlier poems, they're more narrative, more anecdotal, more raunchy. And so you can see that relationship. But again, she evolves past that. But one of the places that she started out already a few steps ahead of Bukowski would have been just, again, her sort of musicality, her lyricism inside the poems.
Yeah. I'd love to get to a poem where her music
There's a couple of different kinds of ones. I mean, the title one. But here's one. Here's music. So this poem, how about I read this one? This is American Sonnet number 94. Nostrum, nostalgia. My notes are never, nada, no. Collect against my reluctance. Forced tabulations. They did this, say me, and that there. Why have there been no arrests? No hearings, no justice. What is not offered cannot be refused. I regress, the despoiled child, the deserted schoolyard. Weeper, this is your execution. Weeper, this is your groveling stone. Weeper, yours is the burst and burnings of a city. Stunned, tearless in the uselessness of limp pursuit, breathlessness besets and brings the ass earthward. Rest. The answer yellows and loses its wit, its crispness. My bed to make, my heart to stake, my soul to take. How I committed suicide, I revealed myself to you. I trusted you. I forgot the color of my birth.
Can you walk me through where, mm-hmm. where, like, what is she doing? Can you tell me?
So it begins gesturing like something like narrative, something like mood. So Nostrum Nostalgia, My Notes Are Never, Not I Know, Collect. So she's writing all the time. Again, I'm going to say it as if it's very much close to her speaking Wanda Coleman self, which I also think she does in the poems quite a bit. So this voice cuts in. Why have there been no arrests, no hearings, no justice? You can hear her sort of just talking to herself. So that's mostly like rhetoric. That's not narrative. But then we get the stanza break. And she's like, I regress, despoiled child. It's D-E-S-P-O-I-L-E-D, but it sounds like the spoiled. Mm-hmm. The despoiled child, the deserted schoolyard. And then this thing about weeper, this is your execution. It becomes highly metaphorical, but she's stacking up the weepers. Weeper, this is your execution. Weeper, this is your groveling stone. Weeper. So that's not narrative. That's extremely musical. And you're just not going to find anything like that anywhere in Bukowski. Mm-hmm. And then sort of moving on through the poem, my bed to make, my heart to stake, my soul to take, how I committed suicide. I revealed myself to you. I trusted you. I forgot the color of my birth. I mean, that's all lyrical. That's all music and image and innuendo moving through that poem.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't want mm-hmm. you to close it yet because I want to stick with that music
sure,
a little bit
sure.
more. But to take the musical analogy really literally, mm-hmm. starts almost like in a 4-4 beat or
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And then sure. it all of a sudden goes into like a measure of three or syncopated something, you know,
sure.
where it loses that kind of rigidity, that stackedness.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes snaking almost,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, this couplet, stunned, tearless in the uselessness of limp pursuit, breathlessness besets and brings the ass earthward. So she's essentially like, you get tired and you sit your ass down, but all those S sounds linking through there. I mean, she has a little bit of punctuation through here, rest, period, but mostly she's letting like syntax and syllables,
uh-huh.
alliteration, the sounds of the words themselves are sort of dictating your speed as opposed to like break on a comma, period, dash. So that is snake. That is snake-like. That
yes.
is slithering.
Yeah. But the thing with her poems is I think that they, to go back to rage,
Look, isn't this,
yeah.
this is, I mean, is this rage? You know, breathlessness besets, brings the ass earthward, rest. You know, there's some cynicism. The answer yellows and loses its wit. My bed to make my heart stake. And then how I committed suicide, that's a question. I revealed myself to you. I trusted you. I forgot the color of my birth. So I'm trying to say that with something like that we get in the direction of rage, but it's not
mm-hmm.
rage. There's something else that's happening there that has that in the water, if you follow what I'm saying. But there's other kinds of things that are happening. Again, even like where that question comes from, who is that addressed to? Is that us that read these poems, that look inside of her head? You know,
mm-hmm.
I trusted you. I thought if I let you see who I was, you would see who I was. But I kept forgetting that you just was going to see me as a black woman, you know.
Uh-huh.
So again, that's it's a contemplation and it's a hot contemplation. But it's something, I mean, she's using the rage. Like if you think, is rage a kind of impotent feeling? Like, what do you do with that rage? So maybe it's beyond rage. Like she walks through the day with that rage, and when she gets to her desk, she's doing something else with it. So you can see again how everything in that poem, weeper, this is your execution. Weeper, this is your groveling stone. There's something there. Again, like rage, but more complicated than rage. But who is it directed to? Is it to the self? Like, why are you crying through all of this shit? You know, get tough. Is that to the self? So again, all those kinds of dimensions make something like, you know, is this because she was angry? Much more rich of a kind of exploration, much more dynamic
right.
a question than the poems.
Right, but that's actually why I want to come back to this question of rage, because, well, first of all, there's a trope of the angry black woman,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
which we can't discount.
Sure.
And then second, I feel like when I read her poems, what strikes me is not her rage. It's like you say, it doesn't sit on the page as rage.
Mm-hmm.
Even
but,
though maybe
look,
gestures
I mean,
towards there. It to me, it looks like clarity.
Yeah, I'm just going to go back to like, so let's do the trope of the angry black woman thing.
Yeah.
I think that she is engaging that too. I mean, she was angry and she was black, blacker than most. She would tell you all of that.
Mm-hmm.
She was intimidating. There's all kinds of stories of those things. She was fine with that though. I mean, her attitude, again, to go back to Miles Davis, would be like, yeah, of course I'm angry. But how that angry gets shaped is just another kind of thing. So I'm saying like, I don't think she was running away from any kind of trope. I think that she certainly was even sitting inside of that because she had every right to be an angry black woman. But those poems are, again, taking that thing, taking that sort of beingness that everybody else is putting on her, that everybody else is looking at and saying, you know, we see the color of your birth, and just doing something with it all the time, just making it into something more than a kind of clean response, a clean reaction to her enemies, to her detractors, to her foes. The poems are just doing so much more than that. They're having too much fun to just be concerned with like revenge or vindication or even showing off, even like, you know, they're just, she's just having too much fun to be too concerned with just like one kind of reader or one kind of problem, you know?
Yeah, exactly. What's a poem that for you is really where you can just see her having fun on the page?
Let me see. There's a couple. You know, she got me on that one. I was thinking about it. I mean, here's one. Oh, you know what? This is one that she, there's an audio of this one floats around. I actually never read it out loud.
Oh, but you hear her voice when you would do it.
Yeah, Wanda, why aren't you dead? Do you know this poem?
Yes.
So she's having fun in that, even though that's the kind of fun she has. This is why I said the thing about Richard Pryor and separating that intensity from Richard Pryor's sort of humor versus Bukowski's humor. I mean, Bukowski was quite funny, too. She was very funny, too. But again, because of her circumstances, if I can find this poem, her humor is always got a little bite to it.
Mm-hmm.
There we go, 53. All right, let me see if I can read this one. And yeah, this is her having fun. Wanda, why aren't you dead? Wanda, when are you going to wear your hair down? Wanda, that's a whore's name. Wanda, why ain't you rich? Wanda, you know no man in his right mind want a ready-made family. Why don't you lose weight? Wanda, why are you so angry? How come your feet are so goddamn big? Can't you afford to move out of this hellhole? If I were you, or you, or you, or you, Wanda, what is it like being black? I hear you don't like black men. Tell me you're AC/DC. Tell me you're a nympho. Tell me you're into chains. Wanda, I don't think you really mean that. You're joking. Girl, you crazy. Wanda, what makes you so angry? Wanda, I think you need this. Wanda, you have no humor in you. You are too serious. Wanda, I didn't know I was hurting you. That was an accident. Wanda, I know what you're thinking. Wanda, I don't think they'll take that off of you. Wanda, why are you so angry? I'm sorry. I didn't remember that was so important to you. Wanda, you're always on the attack. Wanda, 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 I wonder, why ain't you dead?
Yeah, I mean, it really stings by the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like,
yeah.
In the beginning, it's sort of, yeah, you're laughing and for a while, and then all of a sudden it just turns.
It's all there. You know what's funny? Like I said, I had some audio of her reading that poem. She kills it. And so as I was reading it, I first was kind of like trying to channel her sound. But eventually I realized that I could just read it as myself, that voice in that poem, which I've so often heard as her speaking to herself.
Yeah.
It fits very perfectly with me speaking to her as well. And I think it would probably work if you read the poem, if a white dude read the poem, if anyone read the poem, because she's sort of suggesting that these critiques are just coming from everywhere as well as inside, which is why she could read the poem too. And it never occurred to me that it might not actually be her just speaking to herself.
Yeah, exactly. So you write early on in the introduction to this book, you quote a mentor of yours who also knew Wanda, and she says about her, she was mean.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, yeah, she could be mean. What made her mean?
Yeah, Wanda, why are you so angry?
I know.
I mean, that's the question she's always getting. So the poem is like going through all of those questions. Again, I mean, this is why she's an amazing poet. And this is the poet that I aspire to be. It's like everything that I feel is a record. Everything has been recorded in the poem. So it's like any question you ask, I should be able to open up a poem and answer that question with a poem. That's certainly how I believe Rhonda Coleman lived. So, you know, I ain't there yet, but I'm sort of saying all of the evidence of her intensities and herself was there. So again, this poem is thinking about that kind of question, and she gives us instances. So when she says, again, the way that I've always heard it is her saying, you know, I hear you don't like black men. But of course, when I say it, suddenly like Austin, her last husband, who was white Jewish painter, flashes through my head. Mm-hmm. And you know, those kinds of marriages were always going to be a challenge. They're a challenge now. And mm-hmm. so she's tracking that too. Like, not only are white people saying that's wrong, but there's black people saying it's wrong too. So her sense of anger, again, is like multi-dimensional. She's not really, she's again, not really reacting to them. Even the way the poem is positioned as questions, I'm still saying she's not the person who's like just gonna level a single response to a single instance. Instead, she's sort of revolving around that question and letting it meditate, and then saying, what you're really asking me is like, why I'm not dead yet. What you're really saying is, we keep trying to kill you. You keep getting mad, but you keep coming back. You know, so again, without ever saying anything like that, she's able to tap into that sense of people's being perplexed by why she's mean or why she's angry. Right. And she's like, read the poem. You want to know why I'm upset? You want to know why I'm mad? Let me read you this poem.
Right.
You know?
But that's why this poem is so interesting. It almost feels like she's drawing a map with all of the ways in which people have problems with her,
sure.
You know?
And the poem's always doing that. Every poem is doing that.
Right.
And the ways that she has problems with herself. I mean, nobody really gets off the hook here.
Do you think that there was any place, group of people, or, you know, where she didn't feel excluded, where she felt like she was a part of that?
Well, she was a strong woman, so you have to think that strength came from some other places. Like, I think she was born with it, mm-hmm. but I also think she would put herself around people who made her feel like she was strong, as opposed to people who made her feel like she was less than that. I think that Austin was tremendously supportive of her. She was, her core self was strong, but you know, when I think about the various tragedies in her life, like losing a son, that stuff is just still, it's sometimes in the basement of the poems, it flickers through, but the tragedies sit as next to those kinds of victories and those kinds of resiliences in the yeah. same manner. What I'm interested in this to say to you is, like, I'm actually interested in like those flickers of vulnerability across the poem.
Yes.
You know what? I pulled out another sonnet here because she has a sequence, and sometimes this comes up in the longer poems too, where she's sometimes just writing letters. So she's got a series of letters to like her sister that was lost, like never maybe born. Maybe it was her older sister. It was a miscarriage or something. Georgiana, I think it is. So those poems show up across the books, not just in one book. But this letter writing thing was always, I'm sure I could find something that makes me say that this is not fully true, but the letters always seem a bit more vulnerable when she takes on that voice. They feel a bit more intimate. And so this poem here, American Sonnet 54, as I said, there's a couple other poems that are like Dearest Cousin. They just show up so much that I start thinking that she does have someone in mind, you know, when she's yeah. writing these poems. So again, this sense of like family, but also a sense of distance, the sense of loss. So I think she wrote some poems like maybe addressed to her father as well. But there's also this thing about vulnerability. But anyway, here's one of them, Sonnet, American Sonnet 54. Dearest cousin, forgive this ruined narrative begging the first element of creation. Last time I was here, I was here. Now, I wonder what exactly are the components of my invisible spectrum. Sun Ra rising. I went for a reading of palms to rediscover disappointment. Better an almost was, said the gypsy, than a never was. Her peculiar conjure left me staring at my naked brown feet for hours. When reverie broke, it was near dawn, mist had occluded the volcano, and I found myself old, alone, sans shelter, from the ever-blessed heat. This note is sent perchance you've wondered what befell one adventuresome one so long ago lost. This missive in an empty Ron Rico bottle set adrift on a sea of flute music, this repetitious rendering of pain. For on my one palm island dwells no such beast as joy. Come on, man. On my one palm island dwells no such beast as joy, the beast of joy. Come on. And that sentence there, so this note is sent perchance you've wondered what befell one adventuresome one so long ago lost. Come on.
That's almost like a Henry James sentence, yeah, whatever, where the clue is like all the way at the end.
Yeah. All kinds of stuff's going on there. And so that poem is, again, this other thing that's also in the fire, but yeah, comes out of the fire a bit more burnt. You know what I mean? Like, she typically comes out of the fire harder, like steel. But sometimes she comes out and she lets those poems into the water as well. Those poems that show her as like, I'm trying to change, and maybe this is the life I've been given. And the palm reader was like, well, better almost was than it never was. And she's like, I'm looking at my naked brown feet and I'm old. You know, she's feeling all kinds of vulnerabilities in a moment like that. But then you get the music, you get the delivery, you get the wit and whimsy, you know, shooting through there. And, you know, again, there's where that resilience comes back.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, I mean, you mentioned already this series of poems written to her older sister. Mm-hmm. And I think the first one sort of explains what's going on. I think her sister was born, mm-hmm, but not never christened because she doesn't have a name. Right. So she gave her the name Georgina, mm-hmm, but, you know.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could read the one on page 216. It's Letter to My Older Sister, number 6.
Cool, yeah.
Before you read, could you maybe tell me a little bit more about her father? Because I had the sense that her father is really, really important to her.
I'm looking because, you know, it's how she ends The Riot Inside Me. The essay is, mm-hmm, about going to her father's grave. So, you know, she's seen the riot. She's sort of dealing with the Rodney King riots. And for solace, she goes, and I think this is the very end of the book. I decided I had to get out of the house and drove out to the cemetery. I had not visited my father's grave in over a year. I did as usual, took grass clippers, a rag, and bottled water, got down on my knees and tied it up, asking as I always do, the unanswerable. So he's a major muse for her throughout it. What that means for their individual relationship or the kinds of jobs he had, I think I concentrate more on the sense that he was, again, a muse,
yeah,
you know, guiding her through the poems.
Yeah.
And I'll say this too, you know, like again in Wanda, Why Ain't You Dead, I Hear You Don't Like Black Men. I know that that is coming too from the worlds that she inhabits. It's coming out of like, how do you line up with the black arts movement? How do you line up with the black aesthetic? And so she is addressing those things, mm, in an honest way, like, I'm gonna love who I love. But for me, the evidence that, like, no brother should feel intimidated by the fact that Wanda Coleman had a couple of white husbands, because you see all through the work a sincere and insistent and recurring love for black men, you know, black people. So the father, I think, is at the core of that. So he just becomes a muse. Anytime he shows up, he's a source of strength inside the poems.
Yeah.
All right. Letter to My Older Sister, number 6. Hi, Georgiana. When you see Pop, tell him I said hello. Just a few days ago, I was recalling him in the light of my near death. We were once again standing off in the dark stall of hospital admissions. It was October 1957. His 43rd birthday was days away, as was my 11th. And I was sick with delusions and fever. You know, as said elsewhere, they've never quite left me. I was wrapped in my favorite heavy blue blanket, pulled straight off the bed in Mama's panic. I was in those blue and white print flannel PJs Mama sewed. I was so sick, I couldn't stay awake, kept going in and out of consciousness. I listened that night as Pop and Mama desperately argued with the white admissions nurse and begged her that I be allowed to see a doctor. They just didn't let any Negro child into the hospitals in those days, especially if the physician didn't oversee the admission himself. I can't drive this city without thinking of Pop. Tell him I'm sorry I haven't been able to keep up the gravesite. Tell him I'm sorry that things haven't worked out as I'd hoped. Tell him I'm sorry that rent, food, and transportation are still the big issues. Tell him I know it's late, that I'm overdue. Yours.
Yeah, there's like no defensiveness in that one at all.
Right.
I mean, she just apologizes for the fact that maybe her life, like not everything in her life worked out, you know, rent and what is the other thing are still the issue.
Yeah, transportation, bills, food, always the issues.
That is the thing that was the hardest to stomach in a way. And I think for you also, as you sort of met her and knew what her struggles were, that you're like, Wanda Coleman? Wait, how do you, of all people, still have money problems, right? Like, you shouldn't have. I mean, in 1997, when her son Anthony died of AIDS, she writes that she was 51. She writes that she didn't have money or insurance to pay for his burial. You just want to kind of reach in and sort of give her that, you know, whatever cushy teaching job or grant or so that she could have just lived in a way.
Now, but this would be the moment where I would have to level up, you know, include Poetry Magazine in this too. Uh-huh. So let's first say, because of the way she wrote, not everybody was on board with her. She's inhabiting the same universe, not only as Sonia Sanchez, who's going to be on one end of that, like this is what a black woman poet is supposed to be, but also Rita Dove, which is another example of a black woman supposed to be, Toy Derricotte. I mean, you know, the numbers, they keep changing as more people come into that circle. But none of those people really look like her. None of those people had the same kinds of challenges so deep into their career, right? So I don't think she's ever in Poetry Magazine. She's barely got any poems on the website, you know, at the time of us discussing this. I hope that changes by us talking about it. So she would count that too, like as a reason she couldn't pay her bills, that there were people who were not giving her grants because they thought she was too black, too mean, too inappropriate, too West Coast, just a stack of reasons. So I'm sort of saying, yeah, that was true, but you don't have to look very far. You can look actually into the world of poetry and see that there clearly were people who weren't including her in their anthologies, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I will say, to do something more positive on that, like she did, I mean, she did get nominated for the National Book Award. People respected her and they were beginning to pay attention to her, but then she was dead, you know, a couple of years later. So in the time before that, in the many decades she was writing before this sort of late recognition, she saw periodicals, magazines, those people that were rejecting her. Poetry is in that 3,000 rejections. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have to look very far to find why she felt like she couldn't pay her bills.
Yeah. When you look at that, do you think that the poetry world has changed in significant ways? You know, let's suppose that she was born, whatever, in 71, like you.
Mm-hmm.
But she was still exactly who she was, right? Just as sort of acerbic and as, you know, like all
and,
of that.
And as poor, too.
And as
poor. That's a significant
right.
part of it.
Do you think that she would have done better or did a no structural changes?
Only if she could be less poor.
Yeah.
But her outrage comes from the fact that she's not sitting where I am. And we know what that was about because she was a black woman. She was a black woman with kids. She was a black woman not with a lot of money. She was a black woman from the West Coast. She was a black woman with an attitude. I mean, she wasn't delusional about why she's not here. So, you know, she also never taught at Kaveh Kanem.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody was a little bit wary of what kind of teacher she would be in the room just based on her attitude. And I think that was a tremendous loss. Would she have been a troublemaker? Maybe. I mean, a troublemaker the way like your aunt is at the picnic, like she's got something to say if there's a reason to say it. And so I don't think she would ever have bitten her tongue. But I also think, this is an important point for me, she really didn't think that any black people were reading her for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in another, maybe our third meeting, she just sort of went long and deep into this story of like getting a bad review from a poet whose name I won't say, and just generally talking about the way people treat her.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she says this, it's me, it's this poet Crystal Williams, Shiona Harvey, it's Tim Siebel's listening to her. And Tim Siebel said, "Well, Wanda, I love you." You know, he said it in this very Tim Siebel's kind of way. And it was true. We were all sort of like, really? You know, you don't think that people read you? But she was generally right. And so when she got back to California, she wrote me a letter, and it started out like, oh, it's so good to see you. I'm sorry I went off on, how people treat me. And then for like the next page, she revisited it all up because she was keeping count. She was keeping score. And she's like, anyway, blah, 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 blah. And he said, well, I just wanted to say, and then that was the end of the letter. She carried that. She carried a very big chip on her shoulder. And so the thing about Kaveh Khanum is that, I think she needed to see that. I think she needed to go into that space and get that love from these young Black poets. And so it never happened. I think they still have it for her. The book is in the world. If they don't know who she is, they'll find out who she is. But to me, that's significant. And I'm putting that in the same category of missed opportunities in terms of who she was or oversights. And again, just to add that, I'm not saying she could teach or she couldn't teach. I think she was brilliant. I think she was a poet. The poet and teacher don't always line up. But I think if you're trying to become a poet, it's better to be in the company of a poet than the company of a teacher.
Yes.
But a real poet, I think, has a right to have a sense of daring and the provocative. And I would say poets like her, you don't want to romanticize the troubled and troublemaking poet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's why she's a real poet. She was always going to be telling the truth. There was no situation where she was going to compromise the poem, no matter what the riches were or what the absence of those riches were. That seems to be the evidence to me.
When you write poetry, where is Wanda for you?
She's with everybody else.
Do you have her lines memorized, let's say? Do you sometimes feel like, oh, this is something she could have written, she's right there? Or is it more diffuse? Am I imagining it all wrong?
I was certainly learning things from her all along the way. So now I would just say, yeah, it's there, it's in me. There's very few poets that I think of as sitting right in front of me. But Wanda, very specifically, just was sort of the guide for the sonnets. When Trump is elected and I'm sort of trying to figure out how to channel this rage and despair and vulnerability. And I think I had started with sonnets. I had started doing some sonnets and they were just called For My Past and Future Assassin. I think I wrote three. I wrote the first one the morning after the election. And then by the Sunday after Trump was elected, it was November 13th. It's Wanda Coleman's birthday. She's a Scorpio. I'm a Scorpio too. So I was like, I didn't know you were Scorpios. And Amber Tamblyn, who's another big fan of hers, was putting this reading on. I feel like it was at Burroughs maybe in Brooklyn. And on that morning when I was getting ready to go, I was like, oh, these are Wanda Coleman sonnets. I could have so much more fun if I just pretended I'm Wanda Coleman. And so I went on writing them. And my goal was really write them for 4 years until Trump got out of office to use them very much the way she was using poetry, just to be like, you know what? These are going to be crazy days. Sometimes I'm not going to know how I'm feeling. The poem is going to help me just be mad. Sometimes I just want to cuss and say all kinds of stuff. So let me do that. But that was all Wanda giving me permission in the form of the American sonnet to go at that. So, I get stuff sometimes because, the book's been out a couple of years now where people will sometimes say that book's very different. Even some of the words you were using, words that I don't even use in the poems, right? Profanities, all kinds of stuff. And I'll be like, that's Wanda Coleman. She gives me permission to actually be wrong a little bit, to just be mad, to be inappropriate. So it's permission. It's not imitation. It's more like stretch in every way you can. It doesn't mean I have to go to a specific poem and imitate it. It means you can sound any kind of way you want to sound here when you're trying to make these poems work. There's certain ways that she's pushing form and pushing language and using all of these things. And again, that no one else is doing. I can't find models of people that have that kind of rhetorical lyric density, registered density. So she's a great source for that. And even if you're the only person doing it, you're all I need, if you follow me. So I would say, if you look at my body of work, whatever you think of it, you certainly see a different sort of language, maybe a certain kind of looseness, I hope, a certain kind of freedom too, all Wanda Coleman.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's a whole bunch of stuff. You could just cut that up.
There was a whole bunch of stuff. I saw you getting gradually hotter, so I was thinking okay, I should wrap this up. But you kept saying stuff that I wanted to hear.
I'm used to be hot. I'm going to definitely turn my AC on.
Yes.
So I'm glad we got some poems in.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like there's one that you didn't read that you're like,
poem that the title comes from. Mm-hmm. The American Sonnet number 95. So this is just when I was thinking about what to call the book, I thought about this poem. I also say about this poem too, when she's talking about from here, I can see the clock tower, she can see NYU, She can see these things where she's not. and thinking about like this thing that she does, this writing that she has been doing through all of her adult life and through all the kinds of tragedies and all kinds of births and glories, is a wicked enchantment. Even sometimes when she reads them, like the spell that's being cast in them. But the wicked part of it is like, there's gonna be trouble that comes with something like, to be enchanted by something like this. So anyway, so this is the poem, American Sonnet number 95. Seized by wicked enchantment, I surrendered my song. As I fled for the stars, I saw an earth child in a distant hallway crying out to his mother, "Please don't go away and leave us." He was, I saw, my son. Immediately, I discontinued my flight. From here, I can see the clock tower in a sweep of light framed by wild ivy. It pierces all nights to come. I haunt these chambers, but they belong to cruel, churchified insects. Among the books, mine go unread, dust covered. I write about urban bleeders and breeders, but am troubled because their tragedies echo mine. At this moment, I am sickened by the urge to smash. My thighs present themselves, stillborn, misshapen wings within me.
Terrence Hayes edited and introduced the selected poems of Wanda Coleman's titled Wicked Enchantment, which came out earlier this year from Black Sparrow Press. Her other collections include Ostinato Vamps from 2003, Mercurochrome, which was nominated for the National Book Award in 2001, Bathwater Wine, winner of the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize in 1999, American Sonnets from 1994, and several other collections, as well as novels, short stories, and essays. Wanda Coleman was the recipient of fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. She died in November 2013, a week after her 67th birthday. Terrence Hayes is the author of seven poetry collections, including American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin from 2018, which takes its epigraph and its form of American Sonnet from Wanda Coleman, Lighthead, which won the National Book Award in 2010, and Hip Logic, which won the National Poetry Series in 2001. Most recently, he published a work of nonfiction titled To Float in the Space Between, A Life and Work in Conversation with the Life and Work of Etheridge Knight, which came out in 2018. He was a MacArthur Fellow in 2014 and teaches at NYU. To learn more about Terrence Hayes, check out the Poetry Foundation website. To learn more about Wanda Coleman, since yesterday, the Poetry Foundation website is again a great place to start. It's where you can find her bio and eight of her poems. But Terrence Hayes was right. For 6 months, there was only one of her poems up. My editor, James Sitar, looked into what was going on and found that it was a combination of things. A mistake in the database, a request to renew permissions that went unanswered. But as of yesterday, that's all solved. So go and check out those Wanda Coleman poems. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.